Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for March 16th, 2007. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science Magazine. Today, we'll talk about the complexities of the interaction between the HIV virus and the host immune system, learn how to get the attention of a fruit fly, and mark the beginning of the International Polar Year with a chat on the waxing and waning of ice sheets. All that, plus the usual roundup of other stories from Science and its online daily news site, Science Now. So stick around. Infection by the AIDS-related virus, HIV, sets off a game of cat and mouse between the virus and the host immune system, with the body's killer immune cells, or CD8 T cells, on the prowl to seek out and destroy HIV-infected cells, and the HIV pathogen itself constantly mutating to escape the attention of those same immune cells. Recent work has emphasized the importance of this so-called immune escape in the evolution of HIV as it has coursed through affected human populations. But a new paper in this week's Science suggests that the situation may not be so cut and dried, and that, in turn, could suggest new strategies for HIV vaccine development. On the line to tell us a bit more is Betty Korber of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, who's the senior author of the new study. Dr. Korber, welcome to the Science Podcast.
Thank you.
Well, first, Dr. Korber, to get us into this story, maybe you could just tell us a bit more about this whole concept of immune escape. How do the virus and the immune system sort of play off each other in this situation?
Basically, the first thing to understand is that we all carry different sets of immune response genes that allow us to see parts of the virus. And these immune response genes focus in on just particular bits of the virus. And so you would have one set and I would have another set. And these genes are highly polymorphic. They're called HLA class 1 genes. And we inherit them from our parents. So this particular set that we have enables us to see particular parts of the virus. And because the virus evolves so quickly, even within the course of a single infection, it evades immune responses. And so back in 2002, there was a science paper by Moore et al. From Simon Mallal's laboratory that showed that depending on what particular set of these class 1 immune genes you had, you could have a fairly predictable viral escape patterns. And what we found and what we've added to that is we now have methods for teasing apart the viral evolutionary history and actually getting much more accurate predictions of which immune escape mutations are real and valid and which ones might be just artifacts of viral lineages, which wasn't really well established before. So we've made a general technique to model these things better.
All right, well, let's look at the work that you've done in a bit more detail. How did you actually work out these lineage effects?
You use some tools called phylogenetic trees, which enable you to see which viruses are more closely related to each other. And so we do our statistics on a backdrop of these trees. When we do that, we're able to pick out correct immune-associated escape mutations in the virus, and we're able to discern ones that are really just artifacts of the genetic heritage of the virus. And then once we did that, we were able to build on it. And our collaborators at Harvard did some really lovely experiments, both to validate that the mutations we were finding were associated with immune escape, and to show that the story is a lot more complex than a simple, highly predictable pattern. Rather, what's immune escape in one person might be immune susceptible in another person. So there's a complicated interplay between immune escape and susceptibility that's really kind of host-specific. And so the predictability, while there, isn't near as cut and dried, I think, as people thought it was before.
So in essence, what we're saying here is that the notion that may have been previously in the community about immune escape as kind of being the primary driver of the virus's evolution and something you could kind of build an approach to vaccines around may not be quite as useful for that?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to think of it. So it still is a primary driver. It's just that it doesn't drive just in one narrow path, but rather there's complex reactions that can have an interplay with viral fitness. So you can have immune escape from one particular epitope, and an epitope is the bit of the virus the immune system sees. You can have immune escape from that in one person with one HLA molecule. That's transmitted to another person who maybe carries that same molecule. So he might escape by having a reversion back to that original mutation, as well as fitness costs causing reversion. So there's kind of a seesawing effect where the virus is toggling back and forth between amino acid patterns, and there isn't just a clear-cut, this is an escape mutation, and so we wouldn't want to include it in the vaccine because that very mutation might be susceptible and useful in another person. So I think that this paper, biologically, the importance of it is it's pointing to favoring a vaccine approach that might provide several antigens within one vaccine to try to cover possible escape routes rather than just maybe a single antigen.
So the lesson, I guess, is that vaccine development for HIV remains a complicated affair.
It does, and that it might be to our hazard to try to oversimplify it. And for me, the other really important part of this paper, and what I'm excited about, is the tool itself, the analytical approach. And it doesn't only have to be applied to this kind of question. So for any variable virus, if you wanted to try to study the relationship between a mutational pattern and a phenotypic characteristic, then this tool would be a very useful strategy for trying to ascertain in a statistically robust framework mutations that are defining particular phenotypes. So in this case, we looked at the host in immunology, and escape is the phenotype, but you might want to look at neutralization antibody sensitivity, or you might want to look for transmission characteristics in viruses, that kind of thing. And the tool would enable you to do those kinds of studies as well with much more robust statistics.
Well, Dr. Korber, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for the interview. It was nice to chat.
Betty Korber is the co-author with Tanmoy Bhattacharya and 18 colleagues of a new study on the forces shaping the evolution of the HIV virus. The paper appears in the March 16th issue of Science. Just around the corner, selective attention and short-term memory in fruit flies. Stay with us.
Did you know that AAAS members help plug the power of science into public policy? Since 1973, we've brought nearly 2,000 scientists and engineers to Washington, D.C. as science and technology policy fellows. They provide scientific analysis to policymakers in congressional offices and in federal agencies. Find out more at fellowships.AAAS.org. AAAS, advancing science careers, enhancing public policy.
We tend to think of brain functions like attention, memory, and the recognition of new phenomena as the province of so-called higher or advanced animal species, like Homo sapiens. But smaller brains, too, can hold big surprises. In a study published in the March 16th Science, Bruno Van Swinderen of the Neurosciences Institute in San Diego, California, reports on evidence that suggests intriguing attention-like functions in the brain of Drosophila, the common fruit fly, as well as some insights on the genes that control those functions. The results provide yet another example of higher cognitive functions in what were once thought to be simple animals. We're pleased to have Dr. Van Swinderen on the line to talk about his work. Dr. Van Swinderen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. Van Swinderen, first, I guess, the broad question, why study the brains of fruit flies at all?
Well, one of the best reasons to study the brains of fruit flies is purely historical. So next to humans, it's one of the best studied animals with over a century of close scientific scrutiny. So to understand how a brain works, it just makes a lot of sense to go with these flies. But more specifically, behavioral experiments on flies have been revealing increasingly sophisticated phenomena relevant to selective attention. So along with demonstrations of learning and memory in flies, researchers have uncovered such sophistications as context generalization and position invariance. So position invariance refers to our ability to perceive a visual object as the same, even if it's smaller or upside down, for example. Context generalization is the ability to separate predictive cues from their background non-predictive context. Flies can do all this. And then importantly, flies can do this with only about 100,000 neurons. So it's a very small brain as far as animals go. So these processes can potentially be fully understood in terms of a neuronal mechanism. And lastly, and maybe most importantly for me, flies display these high levels of cognitive sophistication using a brain completely unlike our own. So they work the same way. They have neurons and similar molecules, but the neuroanatomy is completely different. So understanding these processes in flies should thus point to fundamental mechanisms of perception independent of specific neuroanatomy.
So in a way, the fact that the brains are so different from ours and are sort of expressing some of the same functions is revealing.
Yes, and can be exploited to try to understand what's really happening, as opposed to just be tied to the neuroanatomy.
Well, you mentioned selective attention, and I think that's what you were looking at in particular in your study. What exactly does that mean, and what were the specific questions, you know, about selective attention you were trying to answer?
For me, selective attention is an experience-dependent brain process which filters out most of the world except one dynamic window. So in a way, selective attention is as much about suppression of a simultaneous competing stimuli, as it is actually about selection. So what's important is to find evidence of that suppression, both behaviorally or in the brain. That can be easily done behaviorally in humans. In a fly, it's a bit harder. So I was interested in detecting that in the fly. And to do this, I had to actually record from their brains and try to find neural correlates of suppression of visual stimuli.
Well, that's a very interesting point. I mean, for someone like me, whose main exposure to fruit flies has been on, you know, overripe bananas in the kitchen, I have to ask, how do you measure the brain activity in a fruit fly?
So people do it all the time, actually. You can actually scalp the fly and take a very fancy microscope and look in its brain and look at how dyes, for example, change in correlation with brain activity. So I didn't do that specifically because I was interested in electrical processes in the fly, which are happening at a higher frequency, specifically 20 to 30 hertz. So I actually stuck very small electrodes into the fly brain, glued them in so they look like little champagne glasses sticking out of the fly's head, and then thread a small wire into those champagne glasses and measure what's called a voltage differential. And to be able to do this, the fly has to be tethered, and so it can't fly away.
So once, okay, so you were measuring direct electrical brain activity. How exactly did you set up your experiment to get at the selective attention in these flies?
So animals pay attention to objects which are salient, which means they're conspicuous, and conspicuousness can be added to an object in various ways. One of the ways of adding salience to a visual object is by making it new. So flies, just like humans, are novelty seekers. They respond to novelty. So I devised this what I call a recurrent novelty paradigm, where I exposed flies to two identical objects for periods of time, for example, 100 seconds, and then one of the objects then would suddenly change to another object, for example, a cross to a square or vice versa, and then measure the brain activity in response to that suddenly novel object. And I found a response specifically in the 20 to 30 hertz range in its brain activity. And what was interesting was that this response was transient, right? So when the objects were novel and the flies responded to them, they then tended to respond on average for about 9 seconds, which seems like an awfully long time for a fly. But then when I exposed flies to objects for only 25 seconds, such that a fly had seen the object already 25 seconds ago, it wasn't novel anymore. They did not respond in the same way. So this paradigm sort of showed me two different things. It told me something about the attention span of a fly, so to speak, and also about the working memory of a fly in terms of how long does a fly have to look at an object for it to be novel or not novel anymore.
So what else did you come up with in these experiments?
So I was interested in looking at some classical Drosophila mutants with known effects on learning and memory, to see if they also had attention defects. And what I found is that indeed some of these mutations which affect learning and memory in flies seem to affect the stereotypical temporal processes of selective attention in flies. And what was most interesting was that these effects were important during development. It seemed like brain development was crucial to be able to produce typical, stereotypical attention-like processes. Just like in a human, in a way, that the exposure we have to the environment as a child is going to define to some extent how we pay attention as an adult. And it seemed to be a parallel sort of situation in the flies.
So you essentially not only found that flies actually display selective attention, but there's also reason to tie that to the same genes that are responsible for sort of short-term memory processes?
Exactly, but I have to point out that this doesn't mean that memory genes are directing fly attention, like the mysterious, you know, controller that I alluded to earlier. Rather, these proteins, they modulate memory formation in flies. So they're involved in building a brain capable of sustaining these stereotypical processes in adults.
Well, finally, Dr. Van Swinderen, what would you say all this means in a kind of a broad sense? We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that Drosophila brains are quite different from human brains. Does what you've found here tell us anything about brains apart from the insect realm and about human brains in particular?
Superficially, the way our brain develops during childhood, you know, the connections we make, our history, affects our attention behavior as adults. So there may be a connection there, which I'd like to explore in terms of circuitry in the fly brain. But more broadly, I'm interested in the relationship between selective attention and memory in a small, manageable brain. We remember what we attend to, but we also attend to what we remember. So in a way, this infinite regress, this closed loop between memory and attention, I think in a way that is the ghost in the machine that I'm interested in. That's the mysterious conductor, which I think can be fully dissected in a fly, but maybe not in a human. In humans, that interaction between memory and attention is extremely rich, and that's what emerges as something we call consciousness. But it may be fundamentally a similar process in a smaller brain, exposed to its own experiences, which we can control now in the lab.
Well, Dr. Van Swinderen, congratulations on your work, and thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Bruno Van Swinderen is the author of a new study on attention-like processes in Drosophila. The report appears in the March 16th issue of Science. You can find it on our website at science.sciencemag.org. Coming up in a moment, a look at some polar science.
Did you know that the journal Science was founded by Thomas Edison in 1880? Even Edison's inventive mind could not have imagined its evolution into the world's leading journal of groundbreaking research and scientific news, in print and online. AAAS members can access seminars, podcasts, and all issues since 1880. Read today's stories and preview tomorrow's research, all at www.sciencemag.org. AAAS, advancing science into the future.
This month marks the beginning of the International Polar Year, a worldwide scientific initiative aimed at getting a better picture of where the Arctic and Antarctic regions have been, where they're going, and what it all means for global climate. To mark the beginning of the IPY, the March 16th Science features a special section on the state of the art in polar science. Joanne Baker of Science International in the UK is in the studio with one of the authors featured in the special section.
With me today is Duncan Wingham of the University College London and the Centre for Polar Observation and Modelling. Duncan Wingham is one of the authors of our special issue on polar science. He's written a review describing what's happening to the polar ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland. So Dr. Wingham, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you.
We have heard in the news that polar ice sheets are melting. So in fact, they're both melting and growing. Can you tell us how this happens?
Yes, because ice sheets exist because they are balanced between the snow that falls on them and the ice that either flows off them, as is happening in Antarctica, or simply melts away. So if more snow is falling than is melting or flowing away, it grows. And if more flows away or melts than the snowfall, then it shrinks.
Okay, so that's fairly straightforward. So how do you actually know how much the ice is melting? How do you actually measure the amount of ice in the polar ice sheets? What sort of techniques do scientists use?
Well, we use satellites to do this. These ice sheets are extremely large things, and they're very difficult to get to, and there are very few people on them. So you can't really do it by going onto an ice sheet. You have to do it from space. And we do it by bouncing radar waves off the surface of the ice. And because we know the position of the satellite extremely accurately, and we can measure the time of the radar wave extremely accurately, we can do a few sums, and we can find out what the height of the ice sheet is with respect to the center of mass of the Earth. And if we just watch that over a period of time, then we can see whether the ice sheets are thickening or thinning.
So you've been measuring the volumes of ice in the polar ice caps. What are the masses of ice in the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets actually doing? Are they going up or are they dropping?
Well, the picture is actually rather complicated. If you take Antarctica to start with, in the south, parts of Antarctica is growing and parts of it is shrinking. And in fact, the picture is actually rather complicated. If you go to Greenland, it's simpler in a way. The higher bits are growing, but the parts around the coast are thinning quite rapidly.
So if all that ice melts, what does this do to sea level?
Well, if all that ice melts, as you put it, it would increase sea level by 70 or 80 metres, but that's not a serious possibility. So the more sensible question is how much could melt or flow into the sea? And the answer to that question is possibly as much as 30 centimetres of sea level in the next century.
Okay, so that's not causing all of the sea level rise. Can you tell us how much the sea level is rising now and what's causing that?
Well, sea level today is rising at about 3 millimetres a year. And no, I can't tell you what's causing that. We perhaps understand why 1 millimetre a year is happening. This is to do with thermal expansion, just because if the atmosphere warms, the ocean warms and it expands, just like any other physical thing. But the rise of sea level of 2 millimetres a year, which has been going on for much of the 20th century, remains a mystery. And indeed, one of the things we point out in our paper is that the favourite suspect for the cause, the Antarctic ice sheet, is no longer a suspect because, in fact, its contribution is rather small.
In your paper, you describe streams that have been found coming out from the glaciers, from the bases of them. So how important are these for actually measuring how much melt is occurring?
Well, of course, they're of no importance whatsoever for measuring melt, because the whole point about them is they're not melting, they're flowing off. And indeed, there is in the popular mind an equation between rising temperature and melting ice, and this is a naive equation because in Antarctica it's too cold to melt. What is happening in Antarctica is that some parts of the ice sheet are flowing out, literally flowing out, and floating away faster than snowfall is replacing them. These are the streams that you were describing. And in fact, all of the mass losses, all of the great thinning that's happening in the Antarctic continent is happening through this flowing mechanism. So that is, of course, extremely important because it is the mechanism by which Antarctica is losing its mass to sea level.
So how do you think we should be monitoring the polar ice sheets in the future? What are the most important areas we should be watching?
Well, I think the last 10 years have shown us very, very clearly the parts of the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets that we need to be worried about. We can see it in the data. And in fact, there are relatively few areas, and indeed there's only some 8 glaciers in Antarctica and Greenland which are doing anything interesting at all. On the other hand, these are extremely large glaciers. Just to give you some idea, you could put all of London on them and London would simply go down with them. These are very, very large flows. And in truth, we have very little predictive capability today. We cannot model them very well. So I would say that the continued ability to monitor them space is essential if we want to know what the ice sheet is doing to sea level. But I also think that the ground effort, the effort that is going into Antarctica every year, and particularly under IPY, this needs to concentrate on those flows. So the Antarctic effort is often very distributed around the whole continent, but what we really need to worry about is the 5 glaciers in Antarctica that are actually losing mass, and we need to concentrate our effort there.
Duncan Wingham of the University College, London, is the co-author with Andrew Shepherd of a review on the recent sea level contributions of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets. He was interviewed by Joanne Baker of Science International. Dr. Wingham's review is one of a collection of review and news articles in the March 16th issue that deal with polar science on topics ranging from sea ice to Arctic air pollution to the research contributions of indigenous Arctic peoples. To explore the contents of the section, go to www.sciencemag.org/sciext/polar science. Finally today, David Grimm, the editor of Science's free daily news site, Science Now, is in the studio with Tanisha Riley of AAAS for our usual roundup of other recent stories.
Well, David, welcome back. So what's new on Science Now?
Today we're going to work our way up the mammalian family tree, starting with rats through apes and finally finishing at humans. We'll talk about how rats know how smart they are, what social apes can tell us about ourselves, and finally, why humans haven't wanted to grow up for about 200,000 years.
All right, so the first story is going to be about the limits of our own knowledge, or rather, if you're a rat, you're going to have to explain this one to me.
Right. Okay, so this story has to do all about with this concept called metacognition. And what metacognition is it's basically how you know the limits of your own knowledge. If you've ever gone to sit down at an exam and had a sinking feeling, you've probably experienced metacognition. You've perhaps felt that you really didn't know as much as you thought you should know to complete the exam. And this trait has been shown in a lot of higher mammals, such as monkeys and dolphins. And researchers want to know if perhaps a lower mammal, like a rat, might also be capable of metacognition.
All right. So how do you test self-knowledge in a rat?
Yeah, it's a good question. And what the researchers did was they devised this really ingenious experiment. And what the experiment entailed was basically getting the rats to distinguish between two different types or two different lengths of sound. And they were bursts of static. And the static was either a 1 second burst of static or an 8 second burst of static. And so a long burst or a short burst. And if the rats heard the short burst, they pressed one lever. If they heard the long burst, they pressed another lever. And if they got it right, they got this big food reward. It was about 6 pellets of food. But they could also choose to skip the test entirely and go straight for this food trough and get about 3 pellets of food. And what the researchers found is when the test was easy and the rats were given the shorter, the long sound, the rats always opted to take the test because they knew they were going to get a big food reward and they knew they could get it right. But what the researchers found is when they made the test harder and they used intermediate levels of static. So instead of the 1 or the 8 second burst of static, they used maybe a 3 second burst versus a 5 second burst. And all of a sudden the rats said, hey, this is hard. And they stopped taking the test and they went straight for the food trough. So they went straight for the easy reward, even though it was a smaller reward. And thus they showed that the rats knew that they weren't smart enough to do the hard test. And this is really some of the first evidence that rats are capable of metacognition, just like humans and dolphins and chimps are.
Wow, so smarter rats. Do we really need smarter rats?
That is a question for another time.
Anyway, moving from rats to apes, next we have a story about the benefits of being sociable. I know all about that one.
Right. And bonobos do too. Bonobos are a close relative of ours, and they're also a close relative of chimpanzees. In fact, chimps and bonobos are approximately equally related to us. But chimps are much more studied just because bonobos are pretty rare in the wild. But they have very different behaviors. Chimpanzees tend to be a lot more aggressive and a lot less social than bonobos. Bonobos are they're sort of known as the peaceniks of the animal kingdom. They get along a lot better, and they just tend to be a lot more social than chimps are. And researchers wanted to see whether these different personalities led to differences in cooperation among the two species. And so what they did was they devised an experiment where they put either two chimps or two bonobos in a cage, and they put a plate of fruit outside the cage. And what they found was that when the plate of fruit was sort of divided into very small pieces, easily shareable pieces, there was really no difference between the two groups. That when the groups had the plate of fruit inside the cage, the bonobos share the fruit and the chimps share the fruit with each other pretty much equally. But when the fruit was not as easily dividable, the chimps were much more likely to hog the fruit. One chimp was much more likely to hog the fruit for himself, whereas the bonobos were much more friendly with each other and they shared the fruit a lot more often. And they had one more experiment where they basically put the fruit outside the cage, and the chimps and the bonobos had to work together to bring the fruit inside the cage. And the same thing happened. The chimps were much less likely to work together than the bonobos were. So it shows that this sociality in bonobos tends to allow these animals to cooperate a lot better than chimps.
So what does this tell us that we didn't already know?
Well, what it tells us is that we often very much look to chimps just because they're our closest relative, one of our closest relatives, for behavioral clues to how humans evolve certain behaviors. But this study shows that we should also look at bonobos, which are also close relatives. We shouldn't neglect them because they have different behaviors than chimps, but some of their behaviors may also be behaviors that we share with them.
And finally, David, we move to humans and how long it takes us to grow up.
Right. Well, humans take a long time to grow up. As you probably know, Tunisia, it takes us about 18 years to be exact. And that's actually pretty unique among primates. Chimpanzees, for example, are fully grown by about 12 years. And early human ancestors, such as Lucy, the famous 3.1 million year old Australopithecine, if I'm saying that right, was fully grown by about 14 to 16 years of age. So researchers have wondered why humans are unique in this sort of delayed development. Researchers had a unique opportunity to study this when they came across the lower jaw of an 8-year-old child, which was discovered in Morocco in 1968. And this child was 160,000 years old. Well, the fossil was 160,000 years old. The child was 8 years old. And what they did was they used this technique called synchrotron microtomography.
Okay, what's synchrotron microtomography?
I thought you'd never ask. So synchrotron microtomography is basically a technique which uses X-ray images to probe inside a fossil. And the advantage of the technique is a lot less invasive than a lot of other techniques that paleontologists use. And what they did is they used this synchrotron microtomography on the teeth of this 8-year-old child fossil. And what they saw was these rings inside the teeth, which are sort of like rings in a tree. They're growth lines, and they can tell the researchers how fast the child was growing and at what stage of development it was. And what they found was this 8-year-old, which was 160,000 years old, was pretty much growing at the same rate as an 8-year-old does today. So this shows that even 160,000 years ago, we were still growing, developing as slowly as we do today. And that shows that this is a really unique, not only is it a unique quality of humans, but it's pretty much something that's been with us since we emerged out of Africa about 200,000 years ago.
So what's the advantage of growing slowly for humans?
Yeah, it's a good question. And researchers think it's our slow growth enables us to develop a lot of complex behaviors, such as creating art and speaking languages, and even today, maybe even playing video games. Maybe not so important 200,000 years ago, but some of these qualities were, and it may have given us an evolutionary advantage over species that were around maybe around the same time, like Neanderthals, and our slower growth may have allowed us to outcompete some of these species, which we were maybe a little bit smarter than them.
As usual, David, a great selection. Thanks so much, and we'll see you again next time.
Thanks for having me, Tunisia.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can catch up with these and other stories on the site at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
And that wraps up the March 16th, 2007 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music for the show. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science, on behalf of the journal and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Thanks for joining us.